I hope to get the test papers back very soon to you. In some of the test papers, I was disappointed to find that some seemed quite confused on the question of how the Groth-Wellhausen theory affected the document view as held by Eichhorn. Well, now that is, you might say, fundamental to the whole discussion. And I don't like to take time to go over it again, but I think we should very briefly review it, because if you don't have that in mind, I don't see how you'll get much out of hardly any of the rest of our discussion. The original view, as presented by Eichhorn, is that the Pentateuch can be divided into two documents, J and E. These two documents in Genesis and the first part of Exodus can be distinguished by the use of a different name for God. In Exodus, in the early part of Exodus, thank you. In the early part of Exodus, it is the name Jehovah is revealed to God's people according to the E document. Therefore, after Exodus 6:3, they both use Jehovah ordinarily. So there are some passages after that that use Elohim, but not a great many. And after that, they can be distinguished by style, noting the great difference in style, which is easily observable between Genesis 1 and Genesis 2. That is the simple Eichhorn theory. If proven, it has the great advantage of being a simple theory that it's easy to see evidence for or against it and to make a reasonable decision. Would somebody shut that back door, please? Yes, it's, I think particularly when we have less heat than in midwinter, as I find at home, spring and fall are the hardest times to keep particular rooms warm, because then we don't get so much heat, and this middle section is not heated, so if we keep the door shut there, we get all the heat from here, but if half it goes out into that section that isn't heated, why, we lose it here. So I wish you'd always shut the door when you go through it, connection with class, please. But it's a very simple theory. Simple, clear, you can say, here are the evidences for, here are the evidences against, make your decision. But that theory is held by nobody today. And the theory that is held today grew out of that theory and uses the same arguments that were used for that theory. But the arguments that could be advanced for that theory are much complicated by the change in the theory. And the change in the theory, which Hupfeld introduced, and which was the basic thing in the theory of Groth that Wellhausen popularized, the basic thing in that theory is the recognition that the arguments that would make divide into two documents, E and J, logically also divide the E document into two parts, particularly in the book of Genesis and the early chapters of Exodus. In the very place where the name Elohim is the distinctive thing, in that very place, the E document has to be in turn divided into two interlaced documents. That's Hupfeld's theory, based on the fact, as he said, that the difference in style between two parts of the former E document is just as great as the difference between the E and the P document. In fact, that what he called the second Elohim is more like the style of J than like the style of E. Well, now that's a tremendous overturning of the Eichhorn theory. And I don't see how you can discuss the matter of the Pentateuch of Christians without seeing that for half a century people felt that these two were two diverse styles. And then that since that time they decided that a third to half of that actually is more like this than it is like that. It's a tremendous thing affecting all four of the arguments. Tremendous. And then from Exodus 6:3, where they do not have the divine names as a basis anymore, from there on, they usually simply say J-E is against P. So they still have two documents, but a good bit of what they formerly thought was part of P, of the first Elohim, of the former Elohim, now they consider as being so much like J, they have to call it J-E. But there are places there where they make divisions into J and E. Now that is such a tremendous change in the development of the theory that you really can't discuss the theory without having that clearly in mind. So while many of the papers on which dealt with that particular question showed a very clear understanding of it, there was a large enough number that did not understand it to make me very much disturbed. I don't feel I should take 3 weeks going over it and over it again, because that wouldn't be fair to the other two-thirds of the class. So I've just taken these few minutes now to stress it again, because it is absolutely vital for the understanding. Then there were a number of papers which did not have much understanding of our discussion of the argument about divine name. Now that's not logically the most important thing in relation to critical theory, but that's where the whole business started, and that is a matter which is most used in popular discussion. And I thought we went into that rather clearly and fully, and I believe two-thirds of you have it well in mind. But if you have everything else in the course well in mind and don't have these two particular things, I don't see how I could consider you as having really the basis of the course. Now, I've given out certain papers here. I trust everybody has one. If anybody came in after they were given out, why, see me after class and I'll give you one. But these papers here list in convenient form Driver's Analysis of Genesis. I have taken Driver's first edition, and I have placed, as you notice, P in one line, J in the next, until you get to chapter 15, where in 15 he held that there was certain material in 15 that belonged to E. But he has analysis uncertain there, 15. Many critics think that none of 15 belongs to E. I've divided into P, J, and E, but there's not much E till you get to chapter 20. But between chapter 20 and the end of Genesis, they give a great deal to E and very, very little to P. This is, having it in convenient form like this, makes it easy for you to see how little he gives to P after Genesis 20. And I want you particularly to notice those passages and to see the idea that here's an original document that has a complete story of the early history, the document P. You can see the absurdity of it when you notice that the document gives you full accounts of creation and of the flood, and of various things prior to chapter 20, and from there on, just two or three lines about a person telling when he was born, when he died, or something like that. And it's really inconceivable that a document, claimed to be a complete document, would pass over so many important things so very briefly as that. But we may refer to this a good many times, so please carefully keep it. Now, I said Driver's Analysis of Genesis, but as I say, I took it from the first edition of Driver. Now, this first edition was reprinted many times, and then he got out a revised edition. In the revised edition, you find certain changes, but not a great many. The principal change you find in the revised edition is that chapter 24, chapter 14 rather, he later thinks must come from some other source, not from any of these sources. That's the principal difference in the later structure, because they found the analysis of 14 into divisions very difficult. Oh, I guess I have it here, a special source, just to account for 14, special source. So I have listed on this, in that form here. So this does represent the later form of Driver rather than the earlier. Now, other books, of which many have been published even within the last 10 years, will give you lists of what they put in the different documents. And you will find that there are certain verses on which there is tremendous diversity of opinion. But on probably 4/5 of the verses, there is a very great unanimity. And Driver's here will, just about everything he says, you will find that of the books that have been printed in the last 20 years, 2/3 to 3/4 of them will agree with what he's given here. so that even though this is taken from a book that was printed a good many years ago, it is a very fair representation of what the critics hold on this. Now, we were speaking at our last meeting about the argument from parallel passages. And we noticed the question of independent duplicates, which we discussed to some extent, and then we took up briefly, I believe, the question of interlaced duplicates. There's one alleged duplicate, which is difficult to know under which head to place. This is the story of Jacob's departure. The reason it's difficult to know where to place it is because what they say is the J story of Jacob's departure is found in chapter 27, verses 41 to 45. And what they say is the P story of Jacob's departure is from 27:46 to 28:9. Thus, each of them is continuous. But being right next to each other, they could be considered as interlaced duplicates. And yet, since they come right next to each other and each of them is otherwise complete, they might well be considered as independent duplicates. You could really put it thus under either head. Now, I want to read you what Batten said about this. Batten is a rather old book, but I like to use it because he presents the arguments in order to try to convince you of them, rather than doing as most writers do today, simply assuming that the criticism is true, and then telling you what they believe. Now, he gives, as one story, Genesis 27:41 to 45, and 28:10. The other one he gives us 27:46 to 28:5. And thus, you see, he puts in one story some at the beginning and then a verse after the end and the other in between. So I think an argument can be made for considering it interlaced, just as one can be made, perhaps a better one, for considering an independent duplicate. Now, I would read you each of these two stories. But I think perhaps instead of reading them first and then letting you see what he says are the differences and similarities between them, I think I'll read first what he says about them. And then you'll have those points in mind as we look at the story. He says, are these two independent stories? Or are they rather, as modern critics assert, two varying forms of the same original? There are certain facts that should be carefully noted. The same place is called Haran in one version and Padan-Aram in the other. Each narrative distinctly states that Jacob was sent away. But there are two distinct reasons given for his departure. Number one, to escape the wrath of his enraged brother. Number two, to procure a wife of his own kindred. Then he discusses a little these two reasons. And then he says, according to P, Isaac blesses Jacob before his departure in a way that is truly strange in view of the trick Jacob has played upon him. The source from which this is taken evidently knows nothing about Jacob's fraud in getting the blessing. Many of the alleged contradictions between the documents are based like this on an argument from silence. It is very often assumed that when one document, they take something and give it to one document, then the other document knows nothing about it. But in other cases, they assume that it must have been in both documents, but the redactor simply included the part from one. You see, it's an argument that's used both ways. But here he uses it in this particular way. He says, a source from this is taken evidently knows nothing about Jacob's fraud in getting the blessing. Esau, too, is impressed with the blessing of Jacob, as he would not have been if this writer had known of the trick. A bare reading of the narrative reveals unmistakable signs of duplication. The natural conclusion is, therefore, that these sources each contained an account of Jacob's departure for Syria, but each gives a different cause for that journey. Now, to those of you who have the story of Jacob well in mind, this is
you understand exactly what this meant. But this is an illiterate age as far as knowledge of the Bible is concerned. And so some of you may not have well in mind the story, and I will read you the two narratives as they give them. I suggest you follow them in your Bible. I will read them as Batten gives them. I think he quotes them directly from either the Authorized Version or the Revised Version of 19:1. But there's always a possibility when they present these things that way that they change a word or two to make it read more smoothly in their arrangement. So if you follow it in the Bible, you will see if that should be the case. Now I'll read you first then the story according to J, as the critics understand. This will be Genesis 27, 41 to 45, and 28, 10. Now Esau persecuted Jacob because of the blessing with which his father had blessed him. And Esau said to himself, "The days of the mourning for my father are drawing near. Then I will kill my brother Jacob." But Rebekah heard of the words of her elder son Esau, and she sent for her younger son Jacob and said to him, "Behold, thy brother Esau will have revenge upon thee by killing thee. Now, my son, listen to my voice. Arise, flee thee to Haran, to my brother Laban, and live with him a few days until thy brother's wrath passes away, until thy brother's anger passes away from thee and he forgets what thou hast done. Then I will send and bring thee from there. Why should I be bereaved of you both at one time?" And Jacob departed from Beersheba and went to Haran. You notice he skipped over the 28:10 there. Then in the other one, as he gives it, the P story, is the space that he skipped. Genesis 27:46 to 28:5. And Rebekah said to Isaac, "I am mortally troubled because of the Hittite women. If Jacob take a wife of such women as these Hittites, the women of the country, what have I to live for?" And Isaac called Jacob and blessed him, and commanded him, and said to him, "Thou shalt not take a wife of the women of Canaan. Arise, go to Paddan Aram, to the house of Bethuel, thy mother's father, and thence take a wife from the women of Laban, thy mother's brother. And may God Almighty bless thee, and increase thee, and make thee many, so that thou shalt be an assembly of nations. And may he give thee the blessing of Abraham, to thee, to thy seed with thee, that thou mayest possess the land of thy sojourn, which God gave to Abraham." And Isaac sent Jacob away, and he went to Paddan Aram unto Laban the son of Bethuel the Aramean, the brother of Rebekah, the mother of Jacob and Esau. Now there are the two stories. And you notice, according to one of them, the reason that Jacob leaves home is that after the trick that Rebekah has led him to play on his father, to make the father give him the blessing that the father intended for Isaac, for Esau, but that God had predicted years before belonged to Jacob and should have been given him to him in the first place. That because of that, Esau might kill him and therefore be wise for Jacob to go away for a while until his brother's anger cooled off and then come back. That's the reason given according to this in the J story. But according to the P story, the reason he went was in order to get a wife from the people of their relatives up there instead of getting a wife from the people down here. And so, as you notice, Batten stresses that. The objective is different, he says, in the two stories. The other argument he makes is that one calls the place Haran and the other calls it Paddan Aram. But Paddan Aram, which literally means the plain of the Arameans, would be a reference to the area, while Haran is the name of the place. And if you say that you went to Houston, and that when you were leaving for Texas, people said goodbye, you're going a long distance away, we hope you have a good time down there, and then you read you went and you arrived in Houston at such a time, we would find no contradiction in sometimes using the name of the area and sometimes of the particular place. So that is not really an argument against it. But the argument that there are two different reasons given, two different causes of the trip, is one which can seem like a very powerful argument until you think just a little bit about the situation. In both cases, the reason given is a reason given by Rebekah. In both cases. And Rebekah was a woman
in the situation that they had at that day, where the man was the very dominant head of the community, and even in a situation more like the one we have today, she still, in a matter like this, would have to get Jacob's consent and to get Isaac's consent. And she would have to do it with argument, because she did not have the power to tell Jacob he should go. And she didn't have the power to tell Isaac that he should let him go. She had to persuade them. And what we find is two different reasons for it, but there is absolutely no justification for saying that Rebecca could not have two reasons for it. There is, most things that we do, we have more than one reason. In fact, when you have difficult decisions to make in life, it is very wise to put down your reasons in each direction. And you put down your reason for this, and your reason for that, your objection to this, and your objection to that. Write them down in two columns and compare them. And it is comparatively rarely that there is only one reason that leads you to an important decision. There are all sorts of factors that enter in. And if you have to get other people's consent, if you give them all your reasons for your decision, and it's a decision they are against, they are apt to pick on one of those reasons and argue about it and overlook other reasons which really should have greater importance as far as they're concerned. And so Rebecca did what is perfectly wise if anyone is trying to convince people of something. Take the reason, a reason which you sincerely believe, but a reason which will influence that person and stress that argument to that person. And you don't have to give them reasons that would irritate them rather than leading them to your desire. Now, Rebecca here had two ideas in mind. Rebecca had asked Jacob to fool his father. Rebecca knew that it was God's promise that Jacob would get the blessing. But Rebecca also knew that Isaac was trying to convince himself that the blessing should go to Esau. And Rebecca told Jacob to pretend to be Esau, which he did, and fooled the poor, almost blind old man into doing what he didn't want to do, but what God had said in the very first place was what he should do. And so he did this, and Esau found out he had done it, and Esau was naturally very angry. And it wouldn't have been at all strange if Esau, in a fit of passion, had killed Jacob. Esau would have regretted it very greatly later on if he did. Esau was not a murderer. Esau was a hearty, bluff sort of a fellow, one who felt strong passions one way or the other, for or against, and when he got terribly hungry, he said, "What good's this birthright to me?" He said, "Give me something to eat. You can have the birthright. If I die, it won't do me any good." He was carried away by his feelings of the moment. Now, he might very easily have become so angry at Jacob that he would kill him. He's not the sort of man that would have planned to kill Jacob, that would have laid a plot for it. Esau wouldn't do anything like that. But Esau could get so angry that he would teach him a lesson. And with his strong arm, he would teach him a lesson in a way that would mean Jacob's death. And Rebekah knew it. And Rebekah wanted to get him out of the way until Isaac would cool off, until Esau would cool off. And you know that he did cool off, because when Jacob came back, and Jacob was still afraid of his life of what Esau would do, Esau received him in most friendly fashion, as you remember, after he came back. It was very, very friendly for him. Esau did not maintain a grudge. He was not that sort of man. But he was one who could get terribly angry, and much as he might later regret having struck Jacob quite so hard, nevertheless, that wouldn't bring Jacob back to life. And so Rebecca wanted Jacob out of the way. And Jacob was one who, while by no means a weakling, was not as strong physically as his brother, and had made his way by other means pretty largely. And Jacob was one who, rather than saying, "Well, if he wants to fight me, I'll fight him," he wasn't that sort.
He was one who said, what's the use of risking your life just for your pride? Let's get out of the way and be careful. That was Jacob's general attitude. On the other hand, Rebecca had another reason that might have been almost as important to her. You remember that Esau had married two local women, and that had irritated her very much. She didn't want her sons marrying the local women. She wanted them getting some of their relatives back from the region they had come from. Abraham had sent his servant to get a wife for Isaac up from their relatives up in that area, and she wanted her son to do the same thing. But before this time, Esau had married two of the local women. And after this happened, you remember, when Esau saw how that disturbed him, he sent and got two of the relatives of Ishmael, of his uncle Ishmael, and married these two women also, in order to try to placate his mother for her feelings about him. Well, now, Rebecca had two reasons in mind, and you don't have to say that only one of these was in Rebecca's mind. She had two. Well, now, suppose Rebecca went to Jacob, and suppose she went to Isaac, and she said to Isaac, she said, Esau is very angry at Jacob. Let's send Jacob up to Paddan Aram for a while till Esau gets over his anger. Well, knowing how Isaac felt toward Esau, whom he regarded as a fine, bluff, upright fellow compared with Jacob, who he thought of as rather sneaky, Isaac would have said, oh, forget it, what foolishness, you're always such a Jacob's your favorite, and you're always afraid. After the trick he's done, he deserves it, and if Esau knocks him around a bit, he'll get over it. Esau wouldn't kill him. Esau's not that sort of a man. You know better than that. Why, Isaac would have gotten his back up and would have said, absolutely not. Jacob is not going to Paddan Aram. Let him stay here and take his medicine. It'll do him good. He'll be a better man for it in the end. That would have been Isaac's attitude. But Rebecca goes to Isaac and she says to Isaac, I feel terribly because of these local women that Esau's married. She said, if Jacob marries a couple of women from the land here also, I just don't know how I'm going to stand it. Now she says, why not send him up to Uncle Laban and have him get a wife up there? And Isaac's own wife had been, his father had felt the same way and had sent the servant up there to get Rebecca for him. Isaac says, that's right, he says. Let's do that. And Isaac thought, after the dirty trick that Jacob played on his brother and on me, it'll sort of do him good to get him away from home for a while. Feel a bit homesick and miss some of the things he's had here. And I'm surprised his mother's willing to let him go for a while like that. Actually, she never saw him again. I'm surprised she's willing, but I think it's a good idea, and I'm glad she suggested it herself. So he gives the one argument to Isaac, and it convinces him, and he says to Jacob, you go up there to that land and visit your uncle Laban, and he gives Jacob his blessing. Now suppose that Rebecca also had gone to Jacob with the other Isaac. She came to Jacob, and she said, of course, the way she did, she came to Jacob, and she said, Jacob, Esau, I'm afraid will kill you. Go away till his anger cools off. Jacob says, that's right. Esau's got a pretty strong arm, and remember how he killed that dog the other day when it offended him a little bit? And he loved that dog, but he just got angry and he hit it so hard the dog died. I don't want to get in a situation like that. What's the harm in my going away out of his sight for a little while and I'll come back? After his anger cools off, sure, Jacob was glad to do what I would like to suggest. But now suppose instead of that she's gone to Jacob. And she says, Jacob, you know, I feel awful bad about your brother having married these local women. I want you to go up there and see if you can find a woman up there to marry. Jacob would say, well, what right she got to say who I'm going to marry? After all, Jacob's got two nice wives from this area. Why should I go way up there looking for a wife? I noticed a pretty nice looking girl the other day over there. I was going to go and get acquainted with her a little bit better. Why should I go way up there? So if she had reversed the argument, she would have made Jacob determined to stay where he was and not to let somebody dictate who he was going to marry. And she would have made Isaac determine that Jacob should not be given permission to go under any condition. But she had two reasons in mind, and she gives this reason to each person that would be effective in leading them to do what she had in mind. And so the story, take the two together, it gives us a story of a whole situation in which it was necessary Jacob be willing to go, and it was necessary that Isaac be willing to give him orders, actually, to go. And both were sincere reasons on her part, but she had sense enough to give each of them the reason that would carry weight with that person. And the story as it stands makes a complete whole. Whereas if you divide it into two parts, while they can read smoothly and all the main facts are contained in each, you lose a great part of the importance of the situation if you divide it up the way that the critics divide it. Now, this argument is not original with me at all. This has been advanced before, and Padden was aware of it. So Padden answers this argument. Padden says it might be said that the shrewd Rebecca could not send Jacob off without Isaac's permission, and that she conceals from Isaac her real reason for desiring to get Jacob away, merely inventing the getting of a suitable wife as a pretext. Esau supposes that Jacob had gone away in order to get a wife from his kindred, for he came to the conclusion that Isaac did not like the Canaanite women, and so adds to his harem a wife of Abrahamic descent. But when we follow Jacob to Syria, in Jay's story, his marriage is only an incident. You see, they put the marriage in P's story, and then they say in Jay's story it's only an incident and does not appear to be the real object of his mission. The two motives are therefore consistently preserved through the narrative. You see how he tries to deal with the argument. Actually, it doesn't deal with the argument. It doesn't affect the main features of it at all. You need the whole thing to have a full understanding of the situation. And while the facts are given twice, there is a repetition of the facts that permission, Rebecca wants him to go, she secures agreement, and he goes. But in one case, she secures agreement from Jacob and uses the argument that will carry weight with Jacob. In the other case, she secures permission from Esau and uses the argument that will carry weight with, from Isaac, that will carry weight with Isaac. And then at the end of this story, if we're getting the final permission, the statement is made twice, that it says Isaac sent Jacob away, and then it goes on and says Jacob departed and went. And that's typical of the repetitions you so commonly have in Hebrew style. Yes? Yes. Yes. This is L.W. Batten, who 70 years ago was professor of Old Testament in the Episcopal Divinity School here in Philadelphia. And his book is called The Old Testament from a Modern Point of View. And you don't need to ever apologize to asking a question of that type. That is, where there's something that I have not explained clearly, or I have not made absolutely clear the place something comes from. If I don't make anything clear I'm presenting, please ask me. Because I may not make it clear, or I may make a slip of the tongue. As I think I did, I think I said Pat instead of that. And please interrupt me any time that something is not clear. Now, if you have a different viewpoint to present, or if you ask a question not particularly related to what I'm giving, then I'd appreciate if you would write the question out and give it to me. Because in that case, I will either see that it fits in logically at some later point in our discussion and bring it in, or I'll see you personally about it. But anything I don't make clear, I'd much rather have made clear now than wait till the end of the hour. So I appreciate your question, and certainly no apology is necessary in connection with it. Now, that's the situation then with this, which could be considered as an interlaced duplicate, but perhaps would better be considered as an independent duplicate, since such large sections are here put in each of the two. Now, these interlaced duplicates, as we noticed, are often simply the result of short repetition for emphasis. And they are usually quite incomplete. And the incompleteness is made a cause of alleged contradiction. I've brought that out in connection with this particular illustration that we were just looking at. Another very interesting case of an interlaced duplicate, but one in which the sections are perhaps a little longer than in some of the interlaced duplicates, is the story of the sending out of the spies, which is contained in Numbers. In Numbers 12 and 13. I think Batten also deals with that. Yes, Batten, let's see Batten. Yes, Batten gives those two also. He gives, but you'll see how much more interlaced they are in the fact that Batten gives to J.E. There he calls one J.E. and the other one he calls P. To J.E. he gives Numbers 13, the last half of verse 17, verse 18, the first half of verse 22, the first half of 23, the last half of 26 through 31, the last half of 32 and 33, and chapter 14, verses 3 and 4. I'm not going to give those to you to take now. I'm merely reading them so you will see how he gives a couple of verses to each, and then how the passage in between he gives to the other. Now, any book on Numbers written from a critical viewpoint will show you how they divide it. What I'm interested now is to see the sort of argument that they use. He gives each of the two consecutively here, the J.E. story and the P. story. I think I'll do as I did with the other. I will read you his conclusion before looking at the precise story. He says there are many points of agreement in these narratives, which are apparent at first sight, but there are more striking differences. In P, the spies start from Paran and return to the same place. In J.E., they return to Kadesh and apparently started from that place. See Numbers 32:8 and Deuteronomy 1:19. In P, they spy out the whole of Canaan to the far north. In J.E., they go only to Hebron and the region about there. In P, the report is unfavorable. The land eats up its people. That is not able to sustain them. In J.E., the land is good, but the people are too strong for the Israelites to dispossess. In both versions, the people are discouraged by the report of the spies. But in P, Joshua and Caleb encourage the people, and therefore these two are accepted from the penalty of dying in the wilderness. In J.E., Joshua is not mentioned. Caleb alone bringing in a hopeful report, and he alone is accepted from the penalty. Now you see, he gives quite a series of alleged contradictions between the two stories. The main thing in the story is the same. Spies were sent out, they went into the land, they brought back a report of what they found. Most of the spies said they couldn't conquer it. The people were stirred up against attempting to go, but one of the spies, one or two of them, bring in a hopeful report. The main facts agree, but as he says, there are many contradictions between the two stories, and he says each of them makes a complete story. Now, if you will open your Bibles then to Numbers 13, open them to Numbers 13, he makes his P story. I'll read you the P story first. The P story, he starts with verse 3, the first part, the first half of 3. He says, and Moses sent them from the wilderness of Paran to spy out the land of Canaan. Then he skips to 17, the first half, where he says, so they went up and spied out the land from the wilderness of Zin unto Reboth to the entering in of Hamath. You notice that it's clear to the north of the land. How's that? Chapter 13, verse 17, the first half. Well, was the part, see, he doesn't divide into verses. Was the part I just gave contained? Oh, that's all I see. 17 the first half, and then 21. 17 the first half you had, didn't you? And then he skips to verse 21, and then to verse 25. He doesn't show where the verses part, and I'm just looking on his presenting. But you can see then, to the entering in of Hamath, you say, is in 21. Then he skips to 25. And they entered from spying out the land at the end of 40 days, and they went and came to Moses and to Aaron and to all the congregation of Israel unto the wilderness of Paran. Now, that is all that he gives from the P document about their going and their return. Now, in the J document, that part of the story, he starts with the last half of verse 17, where he says, and then he puts in parentheses, Moses said to them, go up now into the south and go up into the mountain and see what the land is and whether the people who dwell in it are strong or weak, few or many. That's all the second part of verse 17, isn't it? Or is that verse? And is that complete 18? Then he skips to 22, the last half. And they went up into the south, and they came to Hebron. And then 22, the first half, and then he says 23, the first half, and then 26, the second half. Which they went up from the south and went unto Hebron, the first half of 22. Then the last half, the first half. It is 22, the first half, and then 23, the first half. Did I read that?
No.
He continues, and there were Ahiman, Sheshai, and Talmai, offspring of Anah. Just read you what he says and follow it as well as you can. And they came to the valley of Eshcol, and cut down from there a branch and a cluster of grapes, and they carried it between two men upon a staff. Then he puts in parenthesis, and they returned to Kadesh, and brought back word unto them, and showed them the fruit of the land. Now that's just the first part. They're going up and coming back in the two. And you notice he said that the contradiction was that in P, they start from Paran and return to the same place. In J-E, they return to Kadesh and apparently started from that place. Well, you notice it nowhere speaks of Paran as a place. It says the wilderness of Paran. So it would seem quite evident that it's just like the illustration I gave of Texas and Houston, that the wilderness of Paran is the large area there. Kadesh is the particular spot in that area. And so he makes references to both of them. And they say there's a contradiction, but there's no contradiction from mentioning a place in an area and also mentioning the area. So that's not a contradiction in that part. Then it says, in P they spy out the whole of Canaan to the far north. In J-E they go only to Hebron and the region about there. Well, now if you put the story together, it says they went clear up to the entering of Hamath, but it tells particularly what they did around Hebron. Well, now if you divide them in two and put the one that tells about their going to the northern part in one, and the one that tells about Hebron in the other, you say there's a contradiction. One says they went clear up to the northern end, and the other says they only went to Hebron, but it doesn't say they only went to Hebron. It tells what they did of Hebron, and that is insane, whether they went further or not. If I were to say to you, last week I spent several days in Williamsburg in Virginia and saw very interesting mementos of colonial days there. After returning from Williamsburg, I flew to Florida and spoke in the prophetic conference at Cape Canaveral. You could divide that into two documents. Both of them say that last week I left Philadelphia and went south and came back. But one says I went to Virginia and came back. The other says I went to Florida. and came back. And in one of them, I might say I came to Philadelphia. The other, I might say I came back to Pennsylvania. Or I might say I came back to Elkins Park. There would be no contradiction between the two. But the fact that they went to Hebron, it tells what they did in Hebron. It doesn't say they went only to Hebron. It doesn't say they went to Hebron and came right back from Hebron. So that it is a contradiction that is introduced by dividing it up and then insisting that the what is not told in one of them is denied by it. And you see, that is the way in which so many of these alleged contradictions come in. In P, they spy out the whole of Canaan to the far north. In JE, they go only to Hebron and the region about this. Then he continues, in P, the report is unfavorable. The land eats up its people. That is, it is not able to sustain them. In JE, the land is good, but the people are too strong for the Israelites to dispossess. Now, we have in P, in what they give to P, it says, I don't have the English Bible in front of me. Would somebody read to us? Mr. Scott, do you have the English Bible there? You don't? You do. Mr. Monteith, would you read where it says they came back? They returned to Canaan. They returned from spying out the land. Do you see that? 26. Read us 26.
And they went and came to Moses and to Aaron and to all the congregation of the children of Israel unto the wilderness of Paran, to Kadesh, and brought back word unto them and unto all the congregation, and showed them the fruit of the land.
Yes, go on.
And they told him and said, We came unto the land whither thou sent us, and surely it floweth with milk and honey, and this is the fruit of it. Nevertheless, the people be strong that dwell in the land, and the cities are walled and very great, and moreover, we saw the children of Anak there. The Amalekites dwell in the land of the south, and the Hittites and the Jebusites and the Amorites dwell in the mountains, and the Canaanites dwell by the sea and by the coast of Jordan.
And what's the next verse start?
And Caleb?
Oh, yeah. Well, you notice that here, he says this, what he read is all from the J.E. story, according to the division. Well, now what he says, Batten says, is that in P, the report is unfavorable. In J.E., the land is good. Well, now actually, what you read does show two things. The land is very good, but the people in it are very strong and would be difficult to dispossess. He says, in P, the report is unfavorable. The land eats up its people. That is not able to sustain them. That must be verse 32. Can you read it, 32?
And they brought up an evil report of the land which they had searched unto the children of Israel, saying, The land through which we have gone to search it is a land that eateth up the inhabitants thereof, and all the people that we saw in it are men of a great stature.
Yeah. You see? He says they eat if the people that are in it, and the people are of a great stature. Now, he says eats up the people means that it doesn't produce enough to keep them alive. Now, that is not a necessary interpretation of the verse at all. First, they give the report. What wonderful land. What big crops. What fine produce. But they go right on in the first part, which he gives to J.E., and they say the cities are fortified, the people are strong, and very great. Then when when Caleb and Joshua say, we should go up and possess it, we can do it. Then they say, oh, the land's a land that eats up its people, the people in it are very strong. Well, this, that only thing they have to say that P has an unfavorable report is it's a land that eats up its people. And to interpret that as a land that eats up its people, as meaning a land that doesn't have enough to eat, is certainly reading into the passage. When what they're talking about is that it's a land of big, strong, warring people. And that eats up its people may very well be that it's a land in which only the strong survive. A land in which the powerful ones are in control and we would just be unable to conquer these big, strong cities and so on. So the alleged contradiction here consists of
one gives a whole picture given at the start. The other, as the discussion goes on, they stress one aspect of it. They take a phrase out of that and read into it something which the phrase doesn't have to mean. Well, there's more to this one, but we'll have to stop. I don't want anybody late to chapel, and it's already 2 minutes gone. We'll look at it a little further tomorrow.